Welcome to everyone at tonight's event. I'm very pleased to introduce Professor Kim Sterelny as the winner of the 2004 Lakatos Award. Professor Sterelny graduated from Sydney University and is currently a faculty member in the Australian National University in Auckland, in Canberra that is, and in Victoria University of Wellington, New Zealand. He's also a fellow of the Australian Academy of the Humanities. Now, he started off his career, actually, not quite in philosophy of biology, but rather in philosophy of language and in philosophy of linguistics. And then he moved to philosophy of mind, philosophy of psychology, and currently he's been doing work in philosophy of biology, and that's, of course, the area that the book we are going to talk about is located in. His previous books include The Representational Theory of Mind, Language and Reality, and then one with a juicy title, Sex and Death, An Introduction to Philosophy of Biology. And so now what we have is this award-winning book, equally juicy title, Thought in a Hostile World, The Evolution of Human Cognition. Okay. And now it's my task to introduce this book a bit, and specifically to address the question, there were many outstanding books that came to us for the Lakatos Award, but this one is the most outstanding of the whole batch. So what is it that makes it so outstanding? And so I'm going to give you a little bit of a gloss on it, and I hope that Professor Sterelny will agree with my gloss here. I mean, think about the million-dollar question, what is philosophy all about, all right? Now, I think one, you know, as soon as you say anything in philosophy, it turns out to be controversial, even if you try to give an answer to this particular question. But I think, at least on some conception of philosophy, it's all about human self-understanding. And then, of course, one aspect of human self-understanding is to think about what is it to be a knowing subject? What is it to be a creature in this world that allegedly knows something? Okay, and that, of course, brings us to human cognition. Now, I want to take you back many years or a couple of years or whatever to your introduction class in psychology. So you learned about Pavlovian conditioning, all right? So the dog starts salivating when they hear the bell, and then comes Skinner and operant conditioning. You can teach those pigeons to peck on a lever, and there's food coming. And you say, you know, that's all very quaint, very interesting, very quaint, as long as we're talking about animals here. What about humans, right? Well, you know, it turns amusing, actually. There is these stories about how a professor is being conditioned by, you know, a professor is being conditioned to walk on one particular side of the room and not on the other side, just because the students are paying selective attention. And you say, oh, you know, that's very amusing. But then all of a sudden, I mean, at least that's what happened to me, there is this sort of moment of angst. You hear the scream of Munch, yeah? You say, but is that all there is to human condition? Sorry, is that all there is to human cognition? Maybe we're just like the roaches. Maybe we're just like the pigeons. Maybe we're just like Pavlov's dog. There's nothing special about us. And that's that moment of angst. Now then you think back to what the good book says. And we're created in the image of God. Oh dear, no, we're very special, we're very different, we're radically different from the animals. But then you say, how is it that we're radically different? That story about Pavlovian conditioning can be right. The story about operant conditioning can be right, because we're radically different. We got reason. You say, well, reason, I don't know. Lots of it amongst the dolphins and the primates and so on and so on. Oh, but we got language. Well, yeah, so do the bees. It doesn't get us anywhere. Oh, we can use tools. Well, there is these chimps that, you know, put straws in anthills, and that's how they catch ants. Now, that definitely seems to be a case of using tools. Laughter makes us different. Well, this is a Cheshire cat. No, forget about that. All right. Now, seriously, okay, it seems like there's a certain tension here. On the one hand, the image of God. On the other hand, it's just old conditioning. The roaches aren't any different from us when we're talking about cognition. Now, as so often, it seems like the truth is somewhere in between. We're not just acting on the basis of conditioning processes. There's more to us than that. But at the same time, neither is it the case that we're really radically different, that all of a sudden reason is created out of nothing when humans come to roam the earth. The truth must lay somewhere in between. It's something about how there are various aspects of reason. You have to distinguish between those aspects, and then you have to think throughout evolution that there is some kind of gradient, and as we move from the roaches to humans, we climb up on that gradient, or on those various gradients that correspond to various aspects of reason. That seems to be the kind of story that needs to be filled in. Now, it's that story, really, that transpires too when we look at animal behavior studies. And so I think what I want to say about this book is that it takes a person, it takes a philosopher like Professor Sterelny to bring some structure to this and to look at this research in the light of what does it teach us about human self-understanding. And that's the philosophical moment that comes in. So it's a very important question that is being addressed here. It is done in a way, a very important philosophical question, it is being done in a way that is continuous with the sciences. And so that's why I think this book is a terrific book, and you should all rush and get yourself a copy after the lecture is over. Now there's one last comment that I wanted to make, and that is, when Professor Sterelny is not doing philosophy, what is he doing? His website says that he's eating curries, drinking red wine, bushwalking, and birdwatching. And so with that, I hand it over to Professor Sterelny.
Hi. Thanks, Luke, for that thorough and more or less recognisable introduction. It made me sound rather more important than I am, but I'll live with that. Okay. In his terrific book, The Third Chimpanzee, Jared Diamond begins with a kind of striking feature of the last 3 million years or so of human experience. Points out that if Martian zoologists had turned up on Earth 3 or 3.5 million years ago and sort of seen our ancestors, they wouldn't have looked in any way remarkable. They were a kind of no-account species of woodland ape scruffling around, thinning forests in East Africa, getting their asses bitten off by hyenas and various other far more formidable creatures around. 3 million years later, what's happened? The descendants of that scruffy woodland ape have expanded to every continent except Antarctica, and even a few of them clinging on by their fingernails there. Expanded massively in numbers, expanded massively in technology, basically have turned into a kind of primate swarm that has taken over the Earth. What's the explanation of that? What kind of explains that striking evolutionary dynamics? What explains the transformation of that lineage? So I'm interested in the evolutionary forces that brought about that very striking change in the fortunes of one apparently no-account ape. And I'm also interested, even more interested, in the transformations in us that are a result of those evolutionary processes. So we're the peculiar primate, This is not an autobiography, or at least not an individual autobiography. It's a kind of collective autobiography. It's an autobiography of all of us. And here's how I'm going to go. In the first couple of sections of the talk, which, by the way, I gather will be available from the LSE website if anyone wants it. I'm going to, as you can see, I'm going to talk to some overheads, but the talk exists in full written form, and people will be able to, you know, download it if you want to. Anyway, that's an aside. I'm going to start in the first couple of sections by talking about the nearest thing there is to a received account of what's happened to us and why, which is the account that's been offered by evolutionary psychologists. I don't completely reject that account, but I do think of it as radically incomplete. And so in those first two sections, I'm going to explain both the account and why I think of it as radically incomplete. Then the heart of the talk, sort of basically sections three through to here, is going to lay out both what I think of as the distinctive evolutionary forces that have acted upon us, and also explain what I think of as the distinctive effects of those forces. And then end with a kind of example of these forces in action and how they've resulted in our having the distinctive cognitive apparatus that we have. And then in the final section, I'm going to sort of basically walk through the argument as a whole to try and give you an overall picture of the peculiar primate that I think we've become and why. One very striking discovery of the last 30 or 40 years of cognitive psychology is that ordinary human activity, ordinary human decision making, the kinds of acts and decisions that we make routinely and routinely successfully in our ordinary daily lives, are actually cognitively complex and informationally demanding. This point was first made very vividly by Chomsky and his allies to do with language. Chomsky famously pointed out that language is an incredibly subtle, complex, articulated communication system. And moreover, one that's very unobvious in its structure, given the kinds of experience that people acquiring language have. So Chomsky thought that there was this major problem in explaining how we actually learn a language, and I think he's right, but using a language is also cognitively demanding. In using a language, you've got to have very rich memory for what's going on, because language is involved in conversation, so you've got to keep track of what you've said and what other people have said. You also got to keep pretty acute track of the social and physical environment. Communication isn't mere communication. Communication is typically a tool for coordination. So you're talking in order to do. So you've got to keep track, you know, of how people's actions are going, both yours and others. So conversation and other things weave into one another seamlessly. Also, you've got to be sensitive to cues about whether or not the conversation is going wrong. So as I sort of, you know, talk tonight, I'll at least attempt to keep half an eye on you lot, you know, to see whether you're looking egregiously bored, falling asleep, and so on. In ordinary one-on-one conversations, tracking of that kind is much more important, you know, much more direct. So language is a cognitively complex process, cognitively complex task, both in the learning and in its use. And I think that's true of many human activities. Another example that I like to talk about, I think an example that's easy for us to see why it's cognitively demanding, and that is cognitively demanding, the kind of decision-making tasks that foraging people, you know, make routinely in their foraging lives. So imagine that you're a central American forager. You're out, you know, looking for food. Foragers typically don't accumulate food, so foragers are often under the gun. They've got to make consistently good decisions, otherwise they're in serious trouble. So you're out foraging, you see an armadillo disappear down a hole. Do you try and dig it out? That's actually a demanding problem. You've got to assess what your chances are of digging it out, what the risks are of digging it out, how much food value it's likely to have, whether you're likely to get to keep the food or whether you're going to have to share it with others, and you've got to assess the opportunity costs. What would you have likely to have found if you'd kept on going, if it's going to take you 3 or 4 hours to dig out your armadillo? It's easy for us to see that that's a hard problem, you know, because we know that if we were dropped, in a Central American rainforest, we would have no chance at all of making good decisions of that kind. But we do make similarly good decisions, navigating through our complex life. Drop a Central American forager in LAX and Heathrow, they would be as overwhelmed, by the information and decision-making tasks as we would be dropped in a Central American jungle. The reasons I'm going to come to, I want you to think of the foraging example, because I'm going to argue that it's a rather more typical example of the high information load problems that the people are confronted by. So, how do we solve problems like that? There's a standard story known basically as the massive modularity hypothesis, defended by Steve Pinker and various others. According to the massive modularity hypothesis, what makes you and I smart is not that we have a particularly powerful, particularly sophisticated onboard general learning and problem-solving machine. What makes us smart is that we have a well-designed ensemble of special-purpose cognitive devices, modules. To each important problem that our ancestors faced, there is a cognitive specialisation designed to solve that problem. So, because communication and using language was an important problem our ancestors routinely faced, we have a language module. Because foraging and extracting information from resources from natural history was a problem that our ancestors routinely faced, we have a natural history module. Because not getting ripped off in trade, is a problem that our ancestors faced, we have modules for keeping track of social exchange, and so on. So, the received view of how people solve high-load decision problems, high-information-load decision problems, is via having an appropriate set of cognitive specializations or modules. Human minds are ensembles of modules, essentially. Not that we have no general purpose problem solving capacities, but it's not those that explain the distinctive profile of human cognitive competence. Now, I think there's something right about the modular story. I do think it's likely that we do have, cognitive specializations which are something like the cognitive specializations modular theorists have in mind, but I don't think I think the story is radically incomplete. It's radically incomplete because there's certain very specific assumptions you have to make about human evolutionary history for the modular story to work, and in general, I don't think those assumptions are right. I think they're right for some special cases, but not for the general case. I'm going to argue that while they may well be right in the case of language, they're not right in the case of foraging and many other of the problems that we can routinely solve to a good degree of success. A good degree of success. Okay, so what is a module? Evolutionally, a module is an adaptation. It's an adapted response that's the result of adaptation in our lineage to problems which were enduring, important, and discrete. Enduring because they've got to endure for natural selection to crank away for long enough to build one. They've got to be important, you know, to provide the selective oomph to build a module. And they've got to be discrete because a module has got to be a specialisation. You know, so the problem has got to be one that you can solve more or less independently of solving other problems. Psychologically, modules are innate. They're built into us. You know, on this picture, the information we need to use language is built into us. We don't have to learn it. Because they're innate, they're also developmentally privileged. They develop early and reliable. They're fast and they're automatic. One distinctive thing about modules, one distinctive thing about language and other modular capacities is that you don't need lots of central supervision. And you don't need to decide to hear speech noise as language. If someone speaks to you in a language that you can understand, you can't help but hear it as language. You need lots of training in descriptive linguistics to hear speech sound as phonemes, not to listen to the noises and not to the words. It's a bloody difficult trick, you know, that takes field linguists a lot of learning to do, to partially bracket off some aspects of linguistic experience. On many views, our capacity to interpret others, to judge what other people are thinking and feeling, is similarly modular and it's automatic in the same way. If you made a horrible faux pas, you know, and you can see the expression of disgust and contempt forming on the face of the person that you are hoping to impress, it's impossible not to see those emotions and attitudes in them, however much you would like them. And they're reliable. They're not perfectly reliable. We make mistakes. We make mistakes in linguistic processing. You know, no module is untrickable, but because they're well-adapted machines designed to deal with these important problems, they work very well. Now, I think it's not at all implausible that some aspects of human decision-making are the result of modules in just that sense. So one candidate module is sometimes known as the naive physics module. It's what helps us deal with causal interactions in the physical world. You know, how to use sticks to lever up stones, how to use rocks to break things open, and so on. Now, the physical properties of sticks, stones, and bones don't change. They're nicely stable. So it is possible, you know, that there was an enduring problem, namely how to successfully operate in interacting with physical tools and simple technologies that selected for the capacity for us to keep track of simple physical causal interactions at this time. Stable domain, the information that you needed stayed the same over evolutionally significant periods of time, and hence natural selection could wire that information into your brain. I think the same is plausible for language. For somewhat different reasons, I think it's quite likely that the organisational features of language, its basic structural features, are reasonably stable, reasonably invariant over long periods of time, and hence they could be wired into our brains, hence we don't need to learn them. But I don't think the same is true of many other aspects of human environments. I think humans have evolved in rapidly changing and varied environments, in changing and heterogeneous environments rather than in stable environments. As we're spread out of East Africa, the physical environment in which we live has changed enormously. As human life has changed through technology and so on, the economic basis of human life, kind of technology we use and the resources which we harvest, has changed. Human social organisation has changed and is varied in many ways, in size, in the complexity of the division of labour, in the degree of hierarchy, in the kinds of norms, conventions and so on that are important in human social groups. So the social, physical, economic, biological, economic and geographical aspects of human evolution have not been stable. Because they have not been stable, you can't make a module with the information that needs wide influence. That's a trip that requires environments to be stable rather than unstable. For the most part, with respect to many important problems we've faced, we've lived in a changing world rather than a stable world. So I don't think the modular solution to how we cope with high-low precision problems can be the general solution. It's part of the solution because I do think it's plausible for some of the high-low decisions that we make, but it's not a general solution. So I'm going to argue for an alternative. I'm going to argue that humans have evolved two other tricks, two other techniques for dealing with high-load problems. One is the use of what I'm going to call cognitive technology, following on Dan Dennett and Andy Clark, who have both talked about cognitive technology a lot in thinking about humans and our success in the world. We've made tools for thinking with, as well as tools for doing things with. And I think that's a very important part of how we've come to be as we are. It's also true that we've evolved the capacity to develop onto genetic time rather than evolutionary time, quasi-modules. We automatise skills. Think of the skills that you have for getting around modern environments. You can read. You can do, most of you I imagine, are at least moderately numerate, so that you can handle numeral systems, do simple calculations, many of you, more than simple calculations. No doubt most people in this room can drive. And not just drive, but drive competently, fairly safely, while doing other things. Talking to passengers, listening to music, arguing on the radio. You've automatised those skills in the way that a module is automated. Modules don't need central supervision, they run themselves. We've evolved the trick, of solving various problems by these ontogenetic images of modules. Now, I think that's a very important trick, but it requires very important background evolutionary processes. The two processes that are going on, that I think really matter here, is instead of information that we need being built into our genes, the information that we need is generated and transmitted sociocultural. So I'm going to tell a story in which the socio-cultural generation and transmission of information is incredibly important. It's not good enough just to build information and even transmit information. You have to have a story about how kids can acquire and use that information. And my account of how kids can acquire and use that information is going to depend on a theory of how we've evolved to optimise learning environments. One thing that's very distinctive about human ontogenies is that they're very long compared to other primates. We are kids and fairly helpless kids for a very long time. The second thing that's distinctive about human environments is that they are very highly engineered, they are optimized to ensure that children have the best chance they can have to acquire these skills. You know, these skills are not acquired by accident or happenstance. These skills are acquired because of the systematic informational engineering of children's environments. I'm going to tell a story about the evolutionary mechanisms that have built that. This view of how we've evolved to be able to use cognitive technology and how we've evolved to be able to generate information socioculturally and wire it socioculturally rather than genetically in the human heads will depend on sort of three evolutionary ideas. One evolutionary idea has come to be known as niche construction. And it's the idea that organisms are not passive experiences of their environment. There's a fit between organisms and their environment in many cases. Sometimes that fit is because under selection, organisms change so that they suit the environments that they're in. But it's also true that organisms change their environment. The fit is sometimes in part due to the effects of organisms on their environment rather than adaptations of organisms to their environment. So think of termites. Termites build their own mini-worlds in which they live. Mini-worlds which control temperature, control humidity, are highly effective at keeping out predators, and they build tunnels and trenches into the outside world to harvest resources. So if you walk through the Australian bush, you'll see a termite mound, and you'll see a kind of tunnel branching out from the termite mound, you know, to some wood, you know, that's fallen nearby, and that tunnel is an extension of the termite mini world to the wood which they then harvest. Termites are niche constructors. They don't completely make their own world, but to a very considerable extent they make their own world. They make their own world for themselves, and they make their own world for their descendants. We're niche constructors too. Think of the effects that human technology has on the selected environments in which humans have lived. Think of the effects of fire, of clothing, of shelter, of tools, of weapons on the selective environments in which humans live. These inventions, of course, don't cancel selection out. Humans still live in a selective regime, and some will do better and some will do worse, but they transform the way selection impacts on us. They transform the way selection impacts on us because we in part create our own world just as the world impacts on us. So humans, like termites, are niche constructors. We construct our own environment. We construct in part the environment of the next generation. Moreover, we're cumulative niche constructors. So the next generation inherits a somewhat altered world. They inherit a world in which the biology has been altered, the ecology has been altered, the physical landscape will be altered by human constructions, and they make further alterations which their children then inherit, and further alterations which their children then inherit, and so on, and so on. So, niche construction is not a human speciality. Many organisms niche construct. Many organisms are downstream niche constructors. They construct not just their own environment, but the environments of their offspring. Humans are exceptional, I won't say unique, but exceptional in being cumulative downstream niche constructors. Generation N plus one inherits an altered world and transmits new alterations to the next generation. Moreover, one aspect of human niche construction is informational engineering. We don't just change the physical environment in which we live, we change the informational environment in which we live and in which the new generation grows up. Language itself is one very striking example of informational misconstructing. Labelling and labelling differences makes differences much easier to notice. If you go out in the bush with me in Australia and I point at one very nondescript bird and say, that's a brown thornbill, and point at apparently the same nondescript bird and say, that's a striated thornbill, the existence of those distinct linguistic labels makes it a lot easier for you to notice the subtle differences that actually distinguish those two different species of birds. That's just one aspect amongst many in the way that humans alter not just the physical environment in which they and the next generation inhabit, but the informational environment. And in my view, altering the informational environment is as pregnant for the human story as altering the physical environment. The one thing that dramatically distinguishes us from our close relative, the chimps, is the kind of evolution of adaptations for learning and teaching. We are much more learners by imitation. There's virtually none of that in the chimp world, maybe a little, virtually none. There is probably no deliberate teaching at all in chimp social worlds. There's a co-evolution of the construction of information and the evolution of capacities to use that information. There's no point in developing adaptations for learning and teaching unless you're a species which is generating new information to learn and to teach. Humans are not just very smart by comparison to other primates, we're very cooperative by comparison to other primates. It's a very long time since any human gathered all the resources he or she needed. Hundreds of thousands of years at least, conceivably even longer. Now, cooperation is a notorious problem in evolutionary biology because prima facie there shouldn't be any. Because it should be subverted by the temptation to cheat. It's great to be cooperative because cooperation gives you benefits that you can't get by yourself. But it's even better if other people cooperate and you don't. Because then you get the benefits without paying the costs. In evolutionary biology, that's known as the temptation to protect. And it poses an ongoing problem for explaining how cooperation evolves. There are various attempts solution because cooperation clearly does evolve. One important idea or candidate idea for explaining cooperation is to appeal to selection not just on individuals but also to groups, because clearly groups of cooperative individuals will do much better than individuals who are not cooperative. A cooperative group will kick the ass out of an uncooperative group in any competitive interaction between them. Evolutionary biologists have been very reluctant to appeal to group selection in explaining cooperation, a reluctance which is slowly declining, and for a good reason. Group selection requires very special conditions for it to be powerful. It requires a population to be divided into groups, obviously enough, and for those groups to differ in their extent to which they cooperate, obviously enough, and for that property to be stable and heritable, obviously enough. But it also requires that there's got to be something that stops cooperative groups from being subverted from within. So there's either got to be mechanisms which stop non-cooperators joining cooperative groups where they would white ant them from within, or mechanisms which somehow limit the advantage of non-cooperators in cooperative groups. It's been hard to see in general how either of those conditions could be satisfied. What would stop non-cooperators arising by migration or mutation in cooperative groups? What would stop them having a big advantage? The advantage of the chicks' advantage looks like a big advantage. So it seemed hard to see how group selection could be part of a major part of the story explaining cooperation. That's a good worry. But there are reasons to think that there are distinctive features of human life which make group selection powerful for us, even if it's not powerful in most species. Because the fact that we are cultural species makes group selection powerful. Because it tends to make groups internally homogeneous but vary one from another. And that's precisely the condition which makes group selection powerful. So if you're living in a group with lots of social learning, that's a homogenizing effect. Your kids typically learn what to do by social learning, by learning from what other people in their group do. That will homogenize the group. Even more, the group will be homogenized if those conformist tendencies are reinforced by norms, you know, of any kind. Those processes exist in human social life. Hence, you tend to get a homogenisation within and variation across. And as I say, they're the conditions which make group selection powerful. So while it may well be the case that in general group selection is not a powerful evolutionary force, I think there are good reasons to think that it has been a powerful evolutionary force in our history. And that's important because between them, they transform an important part, you know, of our life. I've been emphasising the importance of the socio-genetic construction, the socio-cultural construction of information. Human action requires lots of information, and typically that information is not wired into our brains by being wired into our genomes. It's built socio-culturally, transmitted socio-culturally, and inserted into human heads socio-culturally. That process requires information pooling. And information pooling is a form of cooperation. If I tell you where there's a fruiting tree, that's as much a piece of cooperation as sharing fruit with you. If I tell you where that something is, where a dangerous predator is, that's as much a piece of cooperation, though a slightly less dangerous one, as helping defend you from a dangerous predator. Information sharing is an instance of the cooperation problem. So you've got to at least partly solve the cooperation problem to get the process of socio-cultural construction and transmission of information up and running. So it's important that group selection is powerful in human evolutionary history because it's part of the story of how we became cooperative, and in turn that's part of the story of how we became smart. There's a very important connection on this view between the cooperative aspects of human life and the cognitive aspects of human life. That is mediated by information pooling at a generation and the collective transmission of information between generations. Both of those are incredibly important for the accumulation of the informational bases of adaptive human action. So, I've argued that humans are distinctive in being niche constructors. We make our own world. We make a world for our children as well as ourselves. Those children inherit that remade world, transform it further, and transmit it to their children, who in turn transform. So we are distinctive in being cumulative downstream niche constructors. We're distinctive in being highly cooperative, probably because group selection has played an important role in our history, so that won't be the only reason why we're cooperative. But we're highly cooperative, we're highly active and interactive in our relations with our environment. We have also evolved under a selective regime which selects for the capacity to deal with the new and the unexpected. We're selected, in other words, for developmental plasticity. Again, developmental plasticity isn't remotely unique to humans. There are very many species of plants which will develop, you know, one form in one environment and a quite different form in another. There are many species of fish, you know, that change sex in appropriate environments. So developmental plasticity, adaptive plasticity, the capacity to generate different phenotypes from the same inherited resources in different environments, is by no means a unique feature of the human lineage. Nonetheless, I think it's an important part of the human story. Adaptive plasticity is important if the environment is unpredictable. If you know what kind of environment your kids are going to be born in, you know what kind of phenotype you want them to have. But if you don't know that, you want them to have the capacity to generate different phenotypes. So if the environment is unpredictable because it's variable or because it's over time or heterogeneous over space, then adaptive plasticity will be. Human environments have been radically variable. In part, that's because of the feature that I've been emphasising. We remake our own world and cumulatively remake our own world. So one reason why human environments have been variable is because we're spread out and hence encountered many different, you know, physical, biological, geographic and climatic environments simply by dispersing. As we've spread, we have also induced alterations into the world in which we have spread, coming from New Zealand. You know, that's a very dramatic, you know, fact of New Zealand life. The biota and ecology, you know, of New Zealand was enormously different, you know, 800 years ago to what it is now. So one reason why human environments are unpredictable and vary is because of our own effects on our environments. But some of it's external forcing as well. We evolved, you know, in Africa in a period of increasing climatic instability. Now, we've done lots of things, but we didn't do the ice ages. You know, that's not down to us. We survived the ice ages, but we didn't cause them. So some of the, you know, dramatically varied environments that humans have encountered has been due to, you know, changes in the world's climate that has nothing to do with us. Some are human-induced. But nonetheless, we've evolved in increasingly unpredictable environments, and hence there's been selection for plasticity. In the human case, that selection for plasticity, you know, has gone through our mind. You know, the main source of phenotypic plasticity in humans, not the only source, the main source is cognitive. It's our capacity to generate different and appropriate behaviours in different environments. Consider again automated skills. Skills like those of the forager. Those skills are contingent. Foraging skills are wired into no one's genes. The foraging skills of Australian Aborigines are very, very different from the foraging skills of Inuits living in the high Arctic, or the foraging skills of Central Americans or people in PNG. So they're contingent. They're wired into no one's genes. They're acquired very slowly. Best ethnographic estimates seem to be that it takes somewhere between 15 and 25 years, you know, to fully acquire the set, you know, of foraging skills that a skilled, you know, hunter or forager has in these communities. But once they're on board, once you've got them, they're automatic, efficient, reliable. I've been out in the bush, with people with their skills, because I've been birding in Central America, and PNG, and these people seem to have, extra sense of sensory equipment, eyes in the back of their head, ears 150 metres from where you are, their capacity to read their biological environment, is simply astounding, and it's just routine to them. They're kind of astonished that you can't do it. At least, after a while, they're less astonished because they can learn by induction that you're blind and crippled and noisy. Until they learn by induction, they're simply astonished. So automatic to them, it's as natural as speaking is to us. It's as natural as driving is to a good driver. But think again how slowly and contingently skills like that. But the adaptive benefit of this plasticity, we have biological adaptations, genetic adaptations to plasticity, but they're beneficial only because of the socio-cultural construction of the information, that can be wired into human heads precisely because they're plastic. No point, in having these very fancy capacities for soaking up lots of very recondite information over long periods of time if there's no information to soak up. So far I've been emphasising the dual importance of the generation by generation construction of information bases and the cultural and biological adaptations that jointly make it possible to wire those databases and skills into human heads. Part of the story though is the use of information technology. Information technology is ancient. Think what an immensely good trick it is when you're going out in the bush and you want to find your way home to mark the trail as you go. You convert a really quite tricky memory and navigation problem into a simple perception problem. Humans have been storing information in the world like that, transforming difficult memory tasks into simple perceptual tasks for a very long time. We've had purpose-built information technology for a long time, 30,000 years plus. But as Stephen Mithen points out, ordinary artefacts at least sometimes serve at the same time as informational artefacts. So a fish spear is something that can use for catching spears, but it's also something you can use to make new dish spears. You can use it as an instruction manual or template or guide for the making of more artefacts of the same kind. Writing and public representation is obviously a kind of informational artefact, piece of cognitive engineering to the max, and that's relatively recent. But people have recoded linguistic data, to make it easy to use for a long time. I mean, Australian Aborigines, basically recode lots of information about the local geographic and biological environment, in songs and stories. The thing about songs and stories is that they're easier to remember than lists. So as well as storing information in the world, turning memory tasks into perceptual tasks, as well as purpose-built technology and technology with information and sidelines, we do this kind of recoding as well. The important thing about this trick, and why I think this trick is probably becoming ever more important to humans, is that it's less sort of time-dependent than the socio-cultural trick of generating databases and transmitting databases. That's a very important way of navigating our way in a difficult world, but only if the world isn't changing too fast. You know, if the world is changing very fast, you know, the data that your grandparents and parents accumulated so painstakingly and transmitted to you and beat into your unwilling head may well be out of date. These sorts of tricks, you know, turning memory problems into perceptual problems, recoding data to make it easier to remember and easier to use, using artifacts as prompts and templates, they're good tricks even in a fast-changing world. So cognitive technology is an important part of the story, but cognitive technology is something, you know, that we need evolutionary preparation to use as well. This too is an aspect of our adaptive plasticity.
Okay.
Let me give a bit of a picture of how all this works with an example. I've been talking, you know, with a few examples, but lots in terms of generalities. Let me give an account of how this view of human evolution and human cognitive architecture looks compared to the standard massively modular view. One of the tasks that humans face is understanding other humans. And we're surprisingly good at it. We're good, you know, at guessing what other people are going to think and do. If you're running late, you know, to meet some friends for lunch, you're pretty good at estimating kind of how late, too late is, you know, so you're pretty good at estimating when you need the phone, or when it's too late to turn up at all. You're good at guessing how pissed off they're going to be, and so on and so forth. We're pretty good at those sorts of tasks. One explanation of why we're pretty good, kind of the received view of why we're pretty good, is that we have an innate folk psychology module. The innate folk psychology module is innately equipped with a theory of how human minds work, what makes us and others tick cognitively. We're innately equipped with that theory, and because we're innately equipped with that theory, we can use it fast and efficiently to solve these problems of social life. And as I mentioned earlier on, this capacity really does kind of look modular. After all, it's fast, it's automatic, it's reliable. You can't turn it off even if you want it. Can't help but see intentional action as intentional when it's intentional. You can't help but noticing how other people are responding to what you're thinking. Well, I think there's an alternative account of these skills in terms of the generation of an automatic skill supported by very extensive structuring of children's learning environments. So, what I want to remind you of is how rich the stimuli here are. Chomsky, in arguing for the innateness of language, Chomsky and his followers talk about the poverty of the stimulus. They talk about how limited and misleading the data are from which language would have to be learned if it really was learned, because the stimulus are so informationally impoverished, the argument is, they can't be learned. Well, whatever the truth of that story is for language, I don't think it's remotely true for the acquisition of interpretive skills, the acquisition of the capacity to understand one another. So think. Firstly, children grow up in an environment which is soaked with agents interpreting one another. So the experience of children is not just of adults wandering around doing stuff. It is also the experience of adults wandering around interpreting others for themselves. You know, one of the things that adults do, you know, is talk about what other people think and want and why. So it's not just dumb behaviour, brute behaviour that children are exposed to. It's also true, you know, lots of that's linguistic, but it's not all linguistic. Children, you know, are treated as agents in many contingent interactions, in imitation games and various other games. There are many social interactions between children and other children and adults, which are basically intentional interactions, where they're treated as agents. Learning is scaffolded by cultural inventions of various kinds. Lots of kids' stories. I mean, I've got a six-year-old, you know, girls. I've had rather more exposure to children's stories than I was really intending to a decade or so ago. And they are full. You know, again, children's stories aren't just descriptions of people doing things. Children's stories are full of simplified descriptions of what people want, why, and so on. Language is a very important cognitive tool here as elsewhere. Now, labelling draws attention to similarities and differences. So the existence of a language in which interpretation and facts about interpretation are couched is a very important part of the process. Indeed, there's evidence with deaf kids who are brought up in non-deaf households and hence have less rich linguistic exposure, their acquisition of these skills is significantly delayed. That's not surprising, because I think language is a tremendously important tool for cueing people in the similarity and difference.
And that's not all. Oops.
Linguists sometimes talk about motherese. They talk about kind of simplified, stylized version of language that caregivers and particular mothers use in interacting with young kids. There are intentional folk psychological versions of motherese. You know, so when mothers interact with their children, they rehearse in simplified and exaggerated ways their own intentional states, their own psychological states, and those of the kid, or at least the states that the kid is supposed to have. Now we want to eat our broccoli, don't we? And so on and so forth. Lots of that goes on. Children learn from other children. And I think that's quite important. One thing that makes the task of learning how to interpret look difficult is with adults, there's this big gap between what they do and what they believe and what they want. With adults, you know, except, you know, when they're drunk at the bar, they're pretty good at suppressing many of their desires and many of their beliefs. So many psychological states don't get obvious traces in behaviour, and hence if you're just looking at adult behaviour, the task of learning how to interpret would look pretty hard, you know, because there are these internal psychological states which cause action, but the relationship between the internal states and the action is very complex, indirect, and often with big time delays. So, you know, the fact that you want someone or something will result in action at some stage, but weeks later, months later. With kids, it's not like that, or at least it's much less like that. 4 and 5 year olds, there's much less time delay, you know, between forming a goal and trying to act on a goal. There's much less filtering of belief and emotion. So the interpretive task, the task of figuring out what a 5-year-old wants from what a 5-year-old does, is much easier, you know, than the task of figuring out what a 25-year-old wants, you know, from what they do. So interacting with your peers, I think, is a very important sort of piece of environmental scaffolding which eases the process, you know, of acquiring these skills. I think it would indeed be very, very difficult, you know, to learn to interpret, you know, by just sort of trial and error on your own, you know, interactions with your social environment. Interpretive skills are genuinely complex and difficult. You know, human beings are complicated, cognitively articulated beings and learning how to sort of track their behaviour by tracking their inner states is a very difficult task. So I accept, that aspect, of the modular story here. But no one has to learn how to do this by their own unaided. Children learn to interpret, in my view, because their developmental environment is structured and scaffolded and organised in a multitude of ways to make that task possible. It would be unlearnable without that scaffolding and structuring, but that scaffolding and structuring is reliably there. And so, given the way our informational environments have been engineered, children grow up not in a poverty-stricken environment, not with the poverty of the stimulus, but with incredibly rich structured stimuli.
Okay, almost done. You'll be delighted to know.
So let me briefly roll through the argument as a whole. Here's how the story looks laid out. Over time, humans both began to alter their environment in increasingly fundamental ways. Very simple technology can have very important environment altering effects. And cooperation became increasingly important in the human life. Those two things combined. The more cooperative humans are, the more powerful their environment-altering capacities become, because people in groups can change things much more powerfully than people individually. So cooperation accentuated group selection. Cooperation accentuated niche construction, and laid down the foundations for information pooling. Information pooling, at a time and over time, is a sort of precondition for the socio-cultural construction of the information humans need to organise their life. At the same time, because our niche construction activities became ever more powerful, our environments became ever more variable at a time. As this whole transformation proceeds, elements of human culture become elements of human biology. They're both in the sense that there are co-evolutionary interactions between culture and biology, and in the sense, that the transmission of information across generations becomes reliable enough to count as imperative channels. Once that's true, once information is constructed and transmitted reliably and accurately enough, the process that Michael Tomasello has sort of identified so importantly, the cumulative construction of information over time becomes more and more important, more and more powerful in human evolutionary history. Different human groups become more differentiated because the accidents of innovation from group to group become preserved, transmitted, and enhanced. And the conditions are then in place which support effective high-load decision-making. We're developmentally plastic, but we're developmentally plastic in ways that are adaptive, because the biological adaptations for plasticity dovetail with the socio-cultural construction of information that plasticity can then take advantage of. So why are humans so peculiar on this story? Well, we're peculiar because we're confronted by and yet can mostly solve fairly well, novel, high information load decision problems. And we can do that because three evolutionary forces, which occur elsewhere in the animal world, come together in human evolutionary history in a distinctive and powerful way. Selection for cooperation has been distinctively important in human evolutionary history. Selection for plasticity has been distinctively important in human evolutionary history. And the selective consequences of our capacities for altering our own environment have been distinctively important in human evolutionary history. It's the coming together of those three factors, which are typically separate, that explains the distinctive evolutionary trajectory that Jared Diamond put his finger on in the third human segment. Thanks.
Why don't we take a range of questions here, and then after five questions or something, you jump in and give the definitive answer to all of them.
You mean five questions, and then, why don't we just answer the questions as they come?
As you wish, we just get to fewer questions that way, but let's do it your way. Okay, let's start there.
Let me start again, sorry. It appears to me that the forager that you spoke about earlier is making use of a tacit knowledge base, and that, for want of a better word, a non-forager is making use of a codified knowledge base. How do you see that affecting the development of those two groups? It would appear to me that anyone that can codify is going to have a far better advantage in the long run.
Some of the forager's knowledge base is no doubt tacit, but some of it's codified. I mean, not necessarily codified in the sense of written down, but people who work on sort of ethnobiology report surprisingly impressive and codified knowledge base that foragers have about their local biological environment. Scott Atron, for example, has done work on the traditional ethnobotany of Central American peoples, and it's very rich indeed, and it's codified. Codified in the sense it's linguistically reportable. They can discuss it. It's articulated. The same is true of Papua New Guinea people's knowledge of their local fauna. So some of it, I agree with the background thought here that sort of codification probably increases flexibility. Once you can sort of make your knowledge explicit, you can do things with it that you can't do while it's completely implicit. So I agree with that background sort of idea, but I think your assumption that forager knowledge bases are mostly uncodified is actually mistaken. I'm sure some of it's uncodified. Some of the recognition capacities, they're very good at sort of, spotting what an animal is, when they just get a glimpse of it zipping by. So they've got these very subtle pattern recognition capacities. That, I'm sure, is not codified. So if you ask them, how did you recognise that was a smooth-billed anik, they probably couldn't tell you. They'd say, well, it flew like one, which doesn't really help that much. But a good chunk of it is codified.
Yes.
Okay. So at some point you said that there is more cooperation in humans, and you said that that's because there has been more group selection in humans. And then you said that there has been more group selection in humans because of the homogenizing effect of cultural transmission, of horizontal transmission, information pooling. But you also pointed out that information pooling is a form of cooperation. So one question that comes up is how the problem of free riding, the problem of the temptation to defect, has been solved in the case of cultural transmission and information pooling. And I was wondering whether you can say something about that question.
I mentioned, as I was sort of talking,
that I didn't think group selection could be the whole story. And you'll put your finger on why I don't think it can be the whole story. I think the group selection stuff that I talked about is best thought of as an account of how once cooperation had got going in hominids, it accelerated, why there was a big cooperation takeoff once it got going. I don't think you can appeal to group selection to explain the early stages, you know, of human cooperation, which will presumably include but not be exhausted by sort of information pooling. So I think to explain how cooperation began amongst our ancestors, though not why it's become so richly elaborated, you've got to appeal to some kind of ecological trigger. My best guess of the ecological trigger, but it's only a guess, is that there was intensified selection on humans for cooperation because basically we lived, you know, in forests which were dwindling, fragmenting. We were changing from being forest apes to woodland and savanna apes. That would have made us much more vulnerable to predation. There's arguments that it also increased selective pressure for female cooperation, you know, because females had to go much further to gather the sorts of resources that they needed. So I think it's plausible, though very far from proven, you know, that there's a kind of ecological trigger of cooperation, which once it got going, you know, and included these elements of cultural differentiation, got massively magnified by a process of group selection. Now, how do you solve the free riding problem in cases like that? Well, there are sort of individual selection models which try and show, you know, that with appropriate sort of reciprocal cooperation, withdrawal of cooperation, you can get effective selection for cooperation despite free riding problems. Whether or not those fit, you know, early, you know, savanna hominins, I'm not sure. There's some reason to suspect that they might, you know, because there is at least some cooperation for defence amongst contemporary baboons that live in somewhat similar environments and were similarly under serious selection pressure because of predation.
More questions?
Yep,
someone back there. I'm
going to
go downstairs first. I'll come to you next, okay?
I guess follow up on the last comment. I'm wondering, if you take that line, what role is information pooling playing in the story, or why you need information pooling? I guess there are two motivations. If you've got the environmental trigger story, I'm not sure what work the information pooling story is then doing, and even if you assume information pooling is triggered in this way, the question, I guess, is an additional question of why the fact that people cooperate in information pooling should then generalise to these other kinds of collaborative activities in which we appear to engage.
Information pooling, you know, is playing a big role in the explanation, once cooperation begins, in how and why humans become increasingly powerful alterers of their own environment. Information pooling doesn't play a particularly important role, at least not obviously an important role, in the initial triggers story. So if the initial trigger is, say, the female cooperation story, you know, because female hominids, you know, once they were woodland and savanna hominids, had to go much further, you know, to gather their resources. It became, you know, important for you know, females to cooperate in childcare, or important for grandmothers to help mothers look after their kids. Information pooling is not playing a central role, you know, in the triggering of cooperation. It plays the central role in getting the co-evolutionary loop, making cooperation, niche construction and increasingly transformative once the cooperation explosion starts to take off. So information pooling, you know, plays a role as slightly later part in the story than the triggering of cooperation.
Let's go upstairs first.
You've argued against the modularity of the of our ability to read others' mind. It seems to me that the argument you have presented against it could be held to any other kind of modules, like the children are surrounded by physics object and they keep falling. And so why do you argue so strongly against the modularity of the theory of mind, and why is it so crucial to you?
Partly because I think it's much less true, you know, that human behavioural patterns are likely, you know, and cognitive patterns are likely to have been stable and unchanging over the large periods of time you need to build a module. The thing about the physical properties of bones and stones is that they don't change at all. You know, the physical property of a branch of wood is the same now as it was 2.5 million years ago, the same now as it was 1.5 million years ago, the same now as it was 100,000 years ago. I don't think those things are likely to be true of human cognitive apparatus. It's because I take plasticity seriously that I think the view I have of why I'm sceptical of the folk psychological module is that's part of the background here. So I think you can give an anti-poverty the stimulus argument against the folk psychological module, even if you think the human minds have been completely unchanged, say, for the last 250,000 years. But I actually don't think human minds have been completely unchanged over the last 250,000 years ago, for the last 250,000 years. So I think that human cognition is part of the changing human environment rather than part of the unchanging human environment, whereas the causal properties of stones is part of the unchanging environment rather than part of the changing environment.
Person over there. Can we go over there?
Thanks. There is something about your argument that surprises me, and it's, although this is certainly not my field, but you emphasize cooperation, information pooling, and all those processes. And I would have thought that the development of those processes was fundamentally linked to the transition from what you could call two-dimensional language, which is speech that allows you to refer to observable facts and events, to three-dimensional language, which is language that allows you to refer to general concepts and to future events. I would have thought that cooperation, information pooling, transmission of knowledge, and so on, would certainly be much help if not it was a necessary condition for the growth of that transition from two-dimensional language to three-dimensional language. And then the question is, what kinds of, for example, brain development might have been implicated in that transition? But you don't seem to refer to that transition at all, and perhaps you don't think that it is important.
I certainly don't want to downplay the importance of language in general, and the increases in the expressive power of language over time. It's obviously very hard, you know, to give anything like an empirically constrained account of how and when that process took place. I do want to agree with Michael Tomasello that language is only going to be part of the story. Michael, for Michael Tomasello, imitation learning is at least in the early stages of the accumulation and transmission of knowledge, as important, maybe even more important, than language. So Tomasello emphasises the fact that the capacity to learn, skills from another person by being able to imitate what they do is rich and a potentially high fidelity information transmission process, and it's relatively independent of language. So I think at least an important part of the account of the accumulation and transmission of knowledge is the accumulation and transmission of skill. Artisanship skill and various other skills, and language might not play a central role in that at all, and even more, the capacities of language that you're talking about, the capacity to talk about the elsewhere and the elsewhere, may well not play a significant role in that. On the other hand, going back to the person who asked about the kind of articulation point of the first question, obviously when you, by the point you've got natural history databases and things like that being developed and transmitted, language is playing a crucial role there. So language is certainly part of the story. I do want to sort of emphasise that it's only part of the story. I don't know myself how crucial a part of the story is the bit that you emphasise, the ability of language, to refer to the elsewhere and the elsewhere. I mean, clearly at some stage, at least in sort of limited ways, that's important because it, warning people about dangers and telling them about resources is talking about the elsewhere and the elsewhere. When all that came on stream and how central it was to this transformation, I don't know.
Let's take one more question in the front here.
Just following on from this, I'm a bit... and also following on from your reference to Tomasello, he talks about an understanding of folk psychology already well begun by 12 months. And I think his understanding of modularity isn't the kind of massive modularity that you're talking about, but rather as a learning device. So I don't understand why you're criticizing a notion of modularity, the theory of mind, while it seems to me that perfectly straightforward, it's very difficult to account for innate, for the 12 months old understanding of intentionality without a kind of modular view. But one can understand this as just a first stage in the building of much more elaborate systems. You just talked about 5-year-olds. It seems to me that one can put a whole story, and indeed I think some of it has already been written.
I certainly don't want to deny that there are specific adaptations for agency, understanding agency. I don't think Tomasello thinks that we have intentionality for the 12 months. He thinks we have joint attention and things like that. And I think he's right. So I think there are, I think there's an important distinction to be drawn, between perceptual capacities and cognitive modules. I mean, and that's not a distinction, that's sort of an ad hoc move, against massive modularity people. That's a distinction they themselves drew in distinguishing their own views, say, from the views of Jerry Fodor, who introduced of modules into the sort of cognitive psychology industry in his modularity book. In the 80s. So I do think we have perceptual capacities which are as innate as anything is in the mind that tune us into important things, to attention, gaze, to facial expression, stuff like that. But that's not understanding other agents as agents. That's not folk psychology. The sense that people like Alan Leslie talk about folk psychology. So perfectly happy to think that we have perceptual adaptations which bias us, in the kind of stimuli to which we attend and
and to which we take notice. That's fine by me.
Well, I think that brings us to the end of this year's Lakatos event. So we thank you all for coming, and join me in thanking our speaker.